As Garland mentioned in our Sunday morning class, we've been studying from the book of Luke for some time now, and we're nearing the end of that book. And there have been a number of recurring themes that we've noticed and talked about during that study. And I want to revisit this morning just a few passages from the book of Luke that I think kind of highlight one of those themes that we have noticed several times during the course of this book. The first of those passages, I've got three that I want to read from Luke that talk about this theme. The first of those is here in chapter 7, starting in verse 36. And this is the longest of the three passages. We're told, "Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, 'This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner.' And Jesus answered and said to him, 'Simon, I have something to say to you.' So he said, 'Teacher, say it.' 'There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more?' Simon answered and said, 'I suppose the one whom he forgave more.' And he said to him, 'You have rightly judged.' Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, 'Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore, I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little.' Then he said to her, 'Your sins are forgiven.'" So that's the first of the three passages, and it's probably obvious what the theme is that I want us to consider, but let's look at one more. This is the passage that Kevin read as we began this morning from Luke chapter 15, the first seven verses. "Then all the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.' So he spoke this parable to them, saying, 'What man of you having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. I say to you that likewise there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 just persons who need no repentance." And then the last of the three passages is here in Luke chapter 18. And this is one that we've talked about several times recently. This is a parable that Jesus taught, in which he said, "Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, 'God, I thank you that I'm not like the other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess.' And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, 'God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.'" Well, Luke gives us several clues about what it is that motivated this parable, and we see him throughout these three passages that we've looked at indicating exactly what it is that was a problem. Here he says in that first verse, verse 9, that he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. So what I think we see in each of these three parables, that, or each of these three passages rather, that illustrate this theme that runs not just throughout the book of Luke, certainly it does in the book of Luke, but really in all of the Gospels, it is the problem of religious arrogance that Jesus had to deal with in the Jews of his time, as they were critical of Jesus because, in each of these passages, they were critical because he associated with sinners, because he ate with sinners or went to visit with sinners and spent time with those that were considered to be religiously inferior. And that religious arrogance is identified as being a big part of that culture and a big problem that Jesus faced. And unfortunately, it's something that we still have to deal with today. We still can face the danger of developing and even sometimes clinging to some form of religious arrogance. It may be slightly different than what the Jews of Jesus' day exhibited, but it can be the same thing even when it takes on other forms. And I think it's something that we probably all have to be on guard against. I know it's something that I have to personally be on guard against, and one of those things that I've struggled with from time to time throughout my life. And I think as we remind ourselves and as we warn ourselves about this danger, this very real danger of developing and having this religious arrogance, we have to ask ourselves, what makes it most dangerous? Or when might we find ourselves really in the thick of it as far as the danger of developing and perhaps clinging to that religious arrogance today? And I don't have an exhaustive list of answers to that question, and I don't know that, we could talk about this many times and still probably think of other things that might be part of this. One of the things that might be a part of us developing religious arrogance is when others don't arrive at the same conclusions that we have reached about whatever the topic is, whatever the subject religiously, in which we find ourselves differing with someone else, when we've reached conclusions that something is wrong, or when we've reached conclusions that something is not wrong and someone else reaches the opposite conclusion. And that's one of those times when we have to be on guard against developing this religious arrogance toward those with which we differ, when we don't arrive at those same conclusions. When it's something that seems really important to us, it becomes more dangerous, I think. You know, if it's something that's incidental that we might disagree on, it may not be as much of a danger. But when it's something that we disagree with someone about and it's something that seems really important to us, then that makes it, I think, for me personally, more dangerous as far as developing that type of religious arrogance that we're talking about. When we look at others and they don't seem to have as much zeal or as much discipline or as much knowledge as we have, and we make those judgments about them, and we look at their behavior perhaps, and we see things that are lacking, and we decide that they just don't have enough zeal, they don't have enough discipline, or they don't have enough knowledge. And that's exactly the attitude that we see demonstrated in the people that Jesus dealt with when they looked down on and despised other people. Simon looked at that woman and saw that she was a sinner. He had identified things about her life that were different from his life, things that she did that were different than his, a lack of discipline, a lack of knowledge, a lack of righteousness on her part, and he judged her as a result of that and demonstrated that religious arrogance that Jesus rebuked on that occasion. When we are convinced that we have arrived at a state of religious perfection that puts us above other people, when we become convinced that we have something that others don't have, that we've attained a level that they haven't attained, and we think of ourselves as being religiously superior to others, then we are definitely in the midst of this religious arrogance that we have to be on guard against. We might be in danger when we view ourselves as conservative and others as liberal. Or when we view ourselves as liberal and others as conservative. Or when we use any labels in a condescending way. When we label people and we use those labels in a way that makes us feel superior about ourselves and makes us identify those others as having some flaw or some fault, then we're in danger of having this religious arrogance that we see all throughout the New Testament. This religious arrogance that is an offense to God in so many different ways. And I think it's something that we really have to be on guard against. For me, my biggest temptation, my biggest problem with religious arrogance personally is when I feel judged by someone else. When I see someone else demonstrating religious arrogance toward me, that's when I'm in the greatest danger of having religious arrogance as a reaction to that. Because I start feeling superior for not having arrogance, which is arrogance about not having arrogance, right? And it's just, it's self-defeating. And I find myself fighting that from time to time when I feel judged by someone else. So it's something that I suspect we all have to face and have to deal with and be on guard against, no matter where we're at, as far as whatever labels we want to apply to the spectrum where we find ourselves, whether we are at one end or the other, we can find ourselves being arrogant religiously toward those who are not just like we are. And that becomes a big problem. And as you read through the New Testament, and you see Jesus facing that and dealing with it over and over and over again, and we looked at just a few examples, we could have looked at many, many more in all of the Gospels. When you realize just how big of a problem it was what kept these people from believing in Jesus. It's what kept them from coming to Jesus. It's what kept them from humbling themselves before him. The sinful woman who was judged by Simon was the one who was laying down at Jesus' feet, kissing them. Simon, in his arrogance, was standing as an equal or even a superior to Jesus, the God that he thought he was worshiping. I mean, who had come in the flesh, and Simon doesn't even recognize him because of his religious pride, his religious arrogance. And so I think it's something that we just definitely have to recognize as a very serious issue, a very serious problem. And yet, I have heard sometimes people try to defend the Pharisees as they go through the New Testament and talk about them in a positive light, like, well, they may have had this or that, but they look at all these things, and try to defend being like the Pharisees. And the Pharisees are not presented as exemplary in the New Testament. I mean, when you read through the Gospels, they were the enemies of Jesus. And they're presented as hostile toward Jesus. And I don't want to side with those that were hostile toward Jesus. So their religious arrogance was never a good thing, ever. And it's something that we have to be totally on guard against having in our own hearts. So there are just several observations or conclusions that I want to talk about a little bit as far as this arrogance is concerned. Religious arrogance will actually prevent us from coming to a greater understanding of truth. And that's one of the ironies about it, because when you have this religious arrogance and you think of yourself as having superior knowledge to others, it actually prevents you from having that superior knowledge. Because if you think you know more than other people, then you won't learn from them, because you don't think you have anything to learn from anyone else. And you think that you've already attained a level that's superior to everyone else's, so you don't learn anything that you don't already know, because that's admitting that you don't know something. And you see, it's a vicious cycle. So religious arrogance causes you to not have a good understanding of truth. Religious arrogance doesn't have to be overtly expressed to be evil, to be bad. What is simply in our hearts may be very offensive to God. It's not something that just happens in the New Testament or in the Gospels. As you go back through the story of the Bible, and when you read through the Old Testament, you see, especially in the prophets, that pride, this type of religious arrogance and pride, is something that Israel faced over and over again and were guilty of over and over again. And the prophets rebuked them over and over again for those times where they were haughty and arrogant toward other people. It's offensive to God. Religious arrogance is always foolish. Well, that may be obvious, but think about it in this way. If you're arrogant about something in which you differ with someone else on some view, whether something's right or wrong, and they've come to a different conclusion, even if you're right on that particular issue, and they are wrong on that particular issue, does that mean you're right on every single issue? Is it possible that there's some issue, some other thing that you might be wrong about? I mean, when we totally get into this religious arrogance, we say, no, there's nothing. I am right about everything. And hopefully we don't ever reach that point. But we're talking about who we are in relationship to God. And Simon's the perfect example. The Simon in this story that we just read in Luke, here he is in his religious arrogance, and he's got Jesus, the Son of God, in his house, and he's being arrogant toward him. How foolish is that? That he could compare himself and find himself superior religiously to the Son of God, the perfect Son of God, who lived his whole life for others. It's always foolish to be religiously arrogant. Religious arrogance is based upon contrasting ourselves with other sinners. Like Simon was looking at that woman and seeing in her something that he didn't see in himself. And Luke tells, she was a sinner. But Simon was a sinner also. He didn't see it, but he was obviously guilty of arrogance. He was haughty toward Jesus, who was in his house, hadn't worshiped him, had not bowed before him, had not exalted him. I mean, instead, he contrasted himself with someone that he saw as being worse than himself. And that's typically what we do in our arrogance. We look at others that we can find some fault with that's different from our own faults, and helps us to ignore our own faults, perhaps, and feel better about ourselves when we look at someone else with a different sin than we have. Religious arrogance is dangerous, so dangerous, because it's comforting. It feels good to view yourself as superior to other people. And that's why it's such a problem. That's why it's such an issue for so many generations. And still, today, it's a problem. It feels good. I know from experience. It feels good to compare yourself to someone else and see their faults and ignore your own and feel good about yourself as being... Let me say this. Self-esteem, I know psychologically, can be an issue that many of us deal with or face. Religious arrogance is not the cure for low self-esteem. It's not a good cure. It may be a false cure where we succumb to this idea of feeling this way because it feels good. Bottom line, we're all sinners who need God's grace, who need God's mercy. And if we start feeling superior to other people, it's offensive to the God who made me and who made that other person. Religious arrogance follows naturally from a works-based view of salvation. If you have a view of salvation that you are saved because you have superior practices, beliefs, understandings, superior ways of worshiping, whatever it is, if you believe that your salvation comes from the works that you do, then religious arrogance is naturally going to flow from that. On the other hand, when you have a grace-based view of salvation, when you understand and appreciate the grace that God shows to us and the fact that none of us deserve it, that none of us have earned it or can earn it, and that any of us who have right standing with God have it only because of God's mercy and His grace and His love, then we won't have this view, this arrogance that comes from works-based salvation. Religious arrogance destroys unity, it creates factions, and it hurts other people who are deemed inferior. It's something that builds walls of separation between people. It destroys relationships. It prevents relationships from happening. When you come to the conclusion that you can't associate with certain or don't want to be friends with certain groups of people because of one thing or another, because they don't believe the same way that you do or they don't have the same practices that you do, and therefore you cannot associate with them, you're on a different path than Jesus was. When you look at the life of Jesus, he was criticized because he did that. And yet there are people who are his followers today who identify more with Simon rather than with Jesus and say, I can't be around those people or I don't want to be friends with this group of people. And what happens is that religious arrogance causes our circle of fellowship to get smaller and smaller and smaller until ultimately we're left sitting alone in the middle by ourselves. Because we judge everyone else around us in our religious arrogance. We judge them as being inferior and we separate ourselves and then we find something else and that same group of people and we make the circle smaller. It's a very serious danger. Jesus said on several occasions, one in Luke that we, in the passage about the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, he said this, but also here in Matthew 23, in different occasions, in different contexts, Jesus said, whoever humbles himself will be humbled. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Religious arrogance is about exalting ourselves. And Jesus says, if you do that, you're going to be humbled. But if you humble yourself, you will be exalted. Peter put it this way in 1 Peter chapter 5. He said, clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud. He's quoting from Proverbs 3. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. Religious arrogance has no place in the life of a Christian, but it's a very serious danger that we can fall into, and we have to be on guard against, always. No matter where we are religiously, there's always the temptation to feel superior to others who are different. And so we have to guard ourselves against that with all that we can. Doug's going to lead us in a song to encourage us to think about where we stand in our relationship to God. It's a song that talks about what Jesus has done for us so that we can be forgiven of our sins. It's a grace-based salvation that we read about in the New Testament. If there's some way we can help you this morning responding to the call of Jesus, let us know as together we stand and sing this song.